taking part in scientific research, even during a pandemic. Here in Maine, there are several well-known citizen science projects that have been underway for years. Maybe you take part in the annual Audubon Bird Count or the Maine Amphibian and Reptile Atlasing Project. Now called community science, these projects involve getting outdoors and observing nature firsthand. But did you know that you can also participate without leaving your desk? You can scan the skies through powerful telescope images on the internet or enter information into apps for public health research. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the power of regular people to fuel scientific knowledge, even during this stay-at-home period. And we'll learn about the variety of projects looking for volunteers. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Spring is gradually arriving in Maine, and one way to get outside and still practice safe distancing is by participating in one of the many community science projects happening across the state. In fact, sometimes you can even participate from right inside your home. We're going to learn about some of those opportunities today. Joining me, Adrian Leppold, a wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife and director of the Maine Bird Atlas, and Doug Hitchcox, staff naturalist at Maine Audubon. Adrian, Doug, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
As always, we want to hear from you out there in radio land. Have you ever gotten involved in some kind of community data collection before? Do you have suggestions for ways to participate, projects you want to tell us about? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call. And I'm going to say this number twice because I know there's another phone number getting thrown out there today. The phone number to take part in Maine Calling, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Adrian, why don't we just start with a primer? What is the idea behind this whole concept of citizen science? I mean, there are a whole lot of people who have almost no scientific training, maybe even haven't taken a science class since high school, out there gathering data. What good is that data?
Well, I think that's the great thing about having an opportunity to share projects like this, is that you're right. The everyday person who doesn't necessarily have a scientific background as far as education is concerned or profession may not think that the things that they see every day, or whatever that they could spend time doing on a daily basis, could actually contribute to something, a larger project that could really benefit from help. And, you know, there are so many research projects out there that require a lot of hours and time looking at just, you know, whether it's like you have in the promo, the looking at photos of stars and telescopic images.
Oh, shoot. Sounds like we lost Adrian. I'm going to go to you, Doug. I understand we've gotten used to the term citizen science, but there's now another term that we're trying to shift toward called community science. Explain the difference, if there is one, and why the term community science.
Yeah, so they're essentially the same thing. The use of the term community science is kind of gaining momentum nowadays, just in an effort to be more inclusive. I don't think that the use of the term citizen in citizen science was ever meant that only citizens of an area could contribute. But, just in a modern 2020 effort to be as inclusive as possible, people are using community science. And, I'll make the point that I would hate for it to ever be, confusing. So you'll see the two terms used. Like in January, I was in Costa Rica, and I would say that I was contributing to several different citizen science projects there, despite not being a citizen of Costa Rica.
I always thought of it sort of being a citizen of the world.
Exactly. That's the best way to think of it.
All right. Well, tell me about what you've seen in your years of being a naturalist, how sort of this citizen science, community science world has changed. We've seen a lot more people getting involved, haven't we?
Yeah, a lot more people, you know, and maybe to just finish the point that Adrian was trying to say is that there's, you know, a lot of projects that are going on, you know, research that scientists want to do. You know, one of the most important things is having kind of a large data set, and you know, much more than a single person could ever contribute. You now have these projects where there are, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, or hundreds of thousands of people contributing to some of them. So you can, it's really just opened up this whole world. And then especially with changes in technology, I feel like are really making contributions to citizen science even more accessible. As a quick point, like there's a great project called iNaturalist, which you would essentially just can upload photos of anything you see, any living thing, basically. And through a kind of essentially machine learning, it can pretty much identify what you've looked at for you. But there's also this great network of professionals who will also look at what you upload, and they'll identify it as well. So it's kind of this great feedback loop that's creating this amazing citizen science project.
So, for example, if you have a bird in your backyard you don't recognize, not only will somebody help you identify it, the algorithm first, then maybe a professional, but maybe a professional might say, wow, where do you live again? And what bird did you see? And that might contribute to knowing that the bird is arriving somewhere it didn't arrive in years past?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, moths are maybe a great example. There are hundreds of species of moths that you can see in Maine. And especially as I'm, you know, stuck in my yard more now, I've been putting up a sheet at night and attracting moths into the light and photographing them. And that, you know, I've got a whole field guide, but that is way too intimidating for me. So I upload them to iNaturalist, and usually by the next morning, they've all been identified for me. And then now it's got the species, the location, the date, and that is very valuable, you know, little piece of data for different projects.
Doug, I realize that a lot of the projects that people get involved in, whether it's the Christmas Bird Count for Audubon or some of the other projects out there, really involve going outside, going somewhere and looking for something. But then there's others, and I just recently learned about this, in which you can sit at your desk in front of your computer and help scientists. Tell me about some of those.
Yeah, you know, I'll say there's probably more than I'm even familiar with, but, you know, even just using that iNaturalist as an example, I often do this with birds. And you know, this is like a good rainy day if I'm stuck inside. I'll just look at, you know, what unidentified birds have been put into that database and, you know, go through, assign that name to them. One that I got really addicted to, just maybe because it's so mindless, if you will, but to help train the algorithm for Cornell's Merlin, which a lot of people will be familiar with as a great way to identify birds they're seeing. One thing they wanted people to do was draw boxes around pictures of birds. It's kind of stretching citizen science, but through their citizen science project eBird and the combination with the Macaulay Library for photos to be uploaded, they wanted people to essentially tag those photos or draw these boxes around them, which you know, again, requires even no knowledge of what birds you're even looking at.
And I've seen things in which programs that are looking at outer space have people scanning images to look for patterns. I've seen people being asked to monitor wildlife cams in other continents, just because another set of eyes is helpful when you're looking for something discrete. We're being joined now by Derek Yorks. He's also a wildlife biologist with Maine's Inland Fisheries and Wildlife Department. Thanks for calling in, Derek.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. Hey, Adrian, everyone else.
I understand that you're part of the longest-running citizen science project in Maine. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So the Maine Amphibian and Reptile Atlasing Project actually started back in 1984 as a joint venture between Inland Fisheries and Wildlife and University of Maine in Orono. So it's on its 36th year and includes almost 14,000 records of reptile and amphibians from all over the state.
So if somebody wants to take part in this, are they assigned a certain plot of land to look for amphibians a certain time of year? How does it work?
Nope. It operates a little bit differently than, say, the bird atlas that's currently underway. Anyone can submit observations of reptiles and amphibians from anywhere within Maine. And it's just an ongoing kind of rolling thing. There's no training or anything. There's two primary ways to submit data. Really what we're looking for is photo observations so that we can verify the species. So one way is by using the iNaturalist app. So it's just a widely available smartphone app, or it can also just be used directly through a web browser. And we have a project within that app that's just titled Maine Amphibian and Reptile Atlas Project.
Great, the Maine Amphibian and Reptile Atlas Project. So if you know that you've got a salamander under a certain rock in your backyard, go out there with either the iNaturalist app or just your camera and get in touch.
Yep, definitely. And the great thing about iNaturalist is the way that project is set up. Even if someone doesn't explicitly go and become a participant of the project, if they document a salamander in their backyard using that app, it will automatically be put into a queue of records to pull from to add to this app.
Wonderful, Derek. We'll put information about the project on our website. Thank you so much for calling in. That's Derek Yorks with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. So happy I have Adrian Leppold back with us. Adrian, tell us about your big project, speaking of atlases.
Yes. So I guess I'll first ask, how do I sound? Clear?
Yes.
Okay. So that would not be a plug for whatever phone that I was using, but I won't say that on air. The Maine Bird Atlas is a five-year effort. We began in 2018, and so we'll be going through 2022. And our goal is to document the abundance and distribution of all breeding and wintering birds around the entire state of Maine. So everything from robins and your chickadees and your mallards and Canada geese to, you know, some of our more colorful warbler species and falcons and things that folks may or may not be familiar with. So this, you know, is a true project for, you know, highlighting the value of folks, as you said in the beginning, who may not have necessarily a scientific background, but, you know, enjoy bird watching as a hobby, even if it's just from their own backyard. And so we are really relying on folks around the state to contribute to this project. And I keep saying to all of my colleagues and all of our volunteers, I just imagine if everyone in the state just submitted observations from their own property, even under this, you know, the current health crisis situation, that would be an amazing data set that is unparalleled in of anything else that we've ever collected. So there's a lot of opportunity to contribute to this project either from home or from afar if you decide to venture out.
That sounds wonderful, Adrian. The Maine Bird Atlas. Does someone have to commit to a regularly monitoring a certain spot? Or if you're just having a great morning and seeing a lot of birds, can you log on and put down what you've seen?
Yes, the latter, as you said. So the great thing about this project is you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and it doesn't matter what you don't know. So you just need to report what you do know, even if it's just, you know, you have hummingbirds coming to your feeders and the chickadees in your yard that you are so fond of. You know, it's whenever and whatever you know and can contribute to. So it really boils down to making note of a few things. So we need the what was it, and again, it doesn't matter what you don't know, just what you do know. Where was it? And we have a whole grid. We've gridded the entire state into 9 by 9 square mile blocks, essentially. And so the where really, you know, if it's in your own property and yard, that's great. That's very precise. But at a minimum, we need it to fit into one of those blocks. When and then what was the bird doing? So you could just, even if you're out in your garden getting things together and you happen to see a bluebird fly into your bluebird house, or, you know, the robin's out in the yard picking at worms and picks one up and flies off with the worm. That's kind of the what. What did you see the bird doing? And that's really all that is required. There's obviously a lot more details, and people can go to maine.gov/birdatlas and click the Get Started button if they haven't already to learn more.
Great. I want to go really quickly to, before we have to go to a break, to Brett in Hancock. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for doing this show today. This is really, really great. I work with the Downey Salmon Federation, and we partner with the Maine Department of Marine Resources and the Nature Conservancy and the Gulf of Maine Research Institute to do a rainbow smelt citizen science monitoring program. And you can check our Facebook page at the Downey Salmon Federation or our website at Maine Salmon Rivers to see how to get involved with that smelt project. So these are little sea-run fish, and then there are similar projects that we and partners run that look for alewives running in streams. So the Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries has a citizen science program for alewife monitoring, and then we have a similar program at Christmas time looking out for tomcod spawning in brooks. So
wonderful
kinds of stuff, not just up in the air. So
Brett, I invite you as well. I know that our web team is listening and going to try to get this on our webpage, but I also invite you to go to today's Maine Calling Facebook post and put information in the comments section about the Downey Salmon Federation project and other projects that you know about. We are going to take a break for our Pledge From Home spring membership drive, but we will be back with more information about community science. Stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Crossroads, Maine's only gender-responsive residential treatment center for eating disorders and addiction. CrossroadsME.org. By Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. And by Maine Community Foundation, working with donors to expedite funding to nonprofits in this unprecedented time. Learn more at mainecf.org.
And you're listening to Maine Public Radio at 1-800-866-1475 is how you can make a difference and support Maine Calling financially tonight, this afternoon. Jen Rooks has said it right. This is a perfect time to support during our Pledge From Home spring membership drive. Spring is in the air, whether it's not quite here yet, maybe a little reluctant. But we're glad to have a program like this on the air here on Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. I'm Mark Vogelzang with Scott Marshaldon. Scott and I are asking for your help to make a difference for public radio. Scott.
Do it now. Give us a call at 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainepublic.org. Mark, this is, you're right. This is our Pledge From Home radio drive. 70%, over 70% yeah. of our fundraising or of our revenue dollars comes from our individual and corporate supporters and donors, and it's you who make Maine Public possible. It's you who make Maine Calling today's show possible. So won't you call and help us today with your donation? Again, 1-800-866-1475.
Well, the birds are always a harbinger of spring. I have a daughter named Robin. Her birthday was just a couple of days ago, so it's always a favorite time for me and the family. But, of course, birds do, they count, they matter. And the fact that we're having a program like this and a discussion with folks all across the state, I love all the voices we've heard from so far. And whether it's rainbow smelt, Scott, you're a fisherman. I know that you love getting out on the rivers and lakes and ponds. There's always something to learn on Maine calling, and that's what this is about. Help support it financially with a gift, whether it's $25 a month or a simple one-time gift of $5 or $500. No matter what happens, we're counting on you.
Well, Mark, Maine is a beautiful landscape, and it offers so much. Maine Public also offers so much to our listeners, to our viewers, to our callers today, and I'm frankly extremely proud of how we've pivoted during these last 2 months of lockdown, if you will, and the, news coverage our news team has been doing. We just heard word one of our audiovisual folks won in a recent award. Lots of things going on, and we are supported by our donors, and it's donor support that makes this all happen. South Portland caller thanking us for our programming and says, there are a lot of us out here counting on you, you being Maine Public. Thank you for calling. Thank you for sharing your support. Won't you help us today by calling 1-800-866-1475 and going online at mainepublic.org?
When you go online, you can see some great ways to say that we have of saying thank you, including a subscription to a language learning program called Babbel. That might be a fun additional thing while we're all together at home. But folks are responding, whether it's Cumberland or Rockland or Old Town. We just heard a gift from Shirley Ellis. Said Shirley is there, and they're increasing their sustaining donation. Thank you so much. We heard from Lebanon, Maine.
Thanks, Shirley.
Yeah, and they said Maine Public Radio is at the top of their list, some folks there. And they're actually using their stimulus check for donating to nonprofits. So it's an interesting idea to help nonprofits around the state and thinking very much about Maine Public. You can join them, and you can make a gift of any size, of any kind, whether it's online, whether it's by a phone call. It's easy to do. The important thing is help. We've been there for you with Maine Public. We hope that you'll be here for Maine Public right now.
That's right, Mark. Give us a call, 1-800-866-1475. We have been here for you, and because you've been there for us. And I'm incredibly impressed in that donor who is using their stimulus check to help fund important nonprofits. That's amazing,
right.
And I'd like to say thank you to them for that. And just for not only for the support, but for the sentiment of what that really truly means, that organizations like Maine Public are incredibly important to them, to you, to us, and that they're saying thank you with sharing their generosity in this way. And we take that extremely seriously here at Maine Public. We utilize every dollar that we can, and to the best of our ability. Mark?
You know, Scott, it is right. We are humbled and honored, and knowing that people entrust this organization with their support. And here's an example of someone who didn't want their name on the air, but from Cumberland. And she says, I love what you're doing, and she is increasing her sustaining donation. So that's an example of how much Maine Calling means to them, how much this radio station means to them. We're going to go back to Maine Calling, lots more conversations. So keep calling, keep listening. And thank you if you've already made a contribution. If you haven't, there's still time. And this is our pledge from home, so we may sound like we're on the telephone. Guess what? We are. And we're both working from our homes. Scott's just down the road from me. I'm up here in Brunswick, and Scott's a little ways away. But, Scott, thanks for this. We'll be back with Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about ways to get involved with community science projects happening across Maine. Our guests are Doug Hitchcox, who is a staff naturalist with Maine Audubon, and Adrian Leppold, director of the Maine Bird Atlas. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to repeat that. It's different than the pledge phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Seth Benz. He is the Bird Ecology Director with the Skudik Institute. Thanks for calling in, Seth.
Welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Tell us about some of the opportunities for people to be involved in community science at SCUDIC.
So besides the projects that both Adrian and Doug spoke about, we have a we use Nature's Notebook, and that is a an app or a computer platform to track the seasonal changes in plants and animals, and that helps us map where things occur, where different plants occur, where different animals occur, all across Acadia National Park. And we think this is important for us to understand the most sensitive biological responses to climate change. So essentially, with Nature's Notebook, you might take a targeted plant, such as a lilac tree or a red maple tree, and you follow that particular plant by using a data sheet, and you do things like, what are you seeing? Are you seeing the flowers blooming? Are the leaves unfolding? Are there fruits? Are things changing colors? And so that particular program is really, really important for us to help in our management of invasive species and perhaps forest pests. Doug spoke a little bit about the moths that he's attracting to light. We do that same sort of thing. And by logging all of these different animals and plants, it gives us an understanding of just what's happening, what's unfolding in nature through the year.
Mm. Tell us how some of the data collected in the past by citizen scientists, community scientists, have given you information that you're able to use today.
So we have one of the projects, of course, is the Christmas bird count. And here at SCUDIC, we've been doing it for 59 consecutive years, not myself, but predecessors to me. And it tells us, it allows us to track the changes in that sort of winter snapshot of birds that we're seeing. For instance, we know here at SCUDIC that over all those years, there's just been 15 different species that have been seen every year. And even though we've had over 85 species on the Christmas bird count since 1960, roughly, so it gives us a historical perspective. We here at the park, we also have the advantage of having societies that were looking at creatures here in the park from well before the park was actually formed, and so. With our current data that we're tracking through iNaturalist and Nature's Notebook, we're able to look back to the things like flowering plants, wildflowers in particular, and see it allows us, again, to track that change when things were occurring back in the early 1900s versus now. And we also have weather data that tells us what has been going on with temperature rising. We also have sea level information. So all of these things that we're tracking are put together to form this mosaic to help us understand what is happening in modern day changes with what we call rapid environmental change. So that historical perspective helps us to look at many different things.
Well, thanks so much for calling in. That was Seth Benz. He was calling from the SCUDIC Institute, and I have to recommend it. If you've never been up to that part of the state, boy, it's gorgeous. We're going to go to Beth Bisson now, who is coordinator for the Signs of the Season program with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension, also associate director of the Maine Sea Grant program. Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Tell us about Signs of the Season and how you've adapted that work due to social distancing guidelines.
Sure. So we are really excited to be celebrating our 10th anniversary this year with the Signs of the Seasons program. And it was great that Seth went just before me, because Signs of the Seasons is a program that is monitoring the climate influences on the timing of seasonal plant and animal changes also. And so we've worked with Skudik Institute and Maine Audubon and many other partners around the state for this program for many years. And so we typically, this time of year, we're very busy out working with our partners. We also work with the Wells Natural Estuarine Research Reserve and Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, doing trainings for volunteers who come to those locations and come do a show and tell. And this year, of course, we've had to adapt things, but I'm really happy to report that we've recorded 3 trainings that are posted online on our website, so anybody can go and watch and listen to those. And then we're available. My colleague Esperanza Stanchoff and I co-manage the program. She works for the University of Maine Cooperative Extension and Sea Grant as well. And we support volunteers who are interested in getting involved and answer questions and help them through the data observations and posting the information online. We also use the Nature's Notebook online database, which is hosted through the National Phenology Network out in Tucson, Arizona. And we use an app, so it's really easy to participate once you're oriented to the program. And our volunteers have actually already this year, in March and April, increased the number of observations that they've been doing by 36% over last year.
Wow.
They establish a site in their own backyard or maybe on a trail where they can still, safely walk and make their observations of common plants and animals, kind of what's flowering, what birds they're seeing, and then log those observations onto the Nature's Notebook site.
Beth, I understand there's another beach project you also wanted to highlight. What is that?
Sure. The Southern Maine Beach Profile Monitoring Program is another program that looks at how climate influence is affecting our coasts. And so that one looks at the forces of erosion, our coastal beaches. And this program, in partnership with Maine DEP and the Maine Geological Survey, is in its 21st year. We also work with Wells National Estuarine Research Reserve on that. And volunteers have been involved right from the beginning, all those 21 years, going out once a month the social distancing is actually built into this program because one volunteer stands with a stick that's tied together with a rope that's actually 3 meters apart, and they measure the profile of the beach, which means how much sand is on that beach and what the angle is from the top of the beach down to the water over time as that changes through storms, as it brings sand in and washes it away, is really helpful for understanding that erosion over the long term.
Well, Beth, thanks so much for calling in. Beth Bisson with the UMaine Cooperative Extension and the Maine Sea Grant Program. I'm going to go to an email from Bruce. Bruce writes, for listeners who have computers powered up and online, they can lend their spare computational power to assist solving important scientific problems. Groups like Science United and BO Inc., Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing, have websites which allow for connecting your computer to networks of many users who collectively pool their CPU power. Projects include astronomy, physics, biomedicine, mathematics, and environmental science. And on Facebook, the Kennebec Estuary Land Trust provides citizen science opportunities for monitoring phytoplankton, birds, and alewives. We use iNaturalist to track observations at our preserves. And finally, an email from Jen. I just wanted to say thank you to Doug and Maine Audubon for participating in the World Series of Birding last weekend. It was really fun to follow along from home while intrepid birders were out in the snow and wind, finding so many species of birds in Maine. So there you go, Doug Hitchcock's a shout out from your friend Jen. We do need to go to another quick break for our Pledge from Home membership drive. We'll be back with more Maine Calling in just a few minutes.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Alt eStore, providing solar power, battery backup equipment, and advice to solar installers and DIYers since 1999. Alt eStore. And by Patriot Subaru, with a mission to serve customers, families, community, and each other. Learn more at patriotsubaru.com.
It's a fascinating conversation here at Maine Public, and I'm Mark Vogelsang along with Scott Marshalden, our development officer, chief development officer, and we're asking you to take a moment to think about the value of this program this day at this moment. Public radio needs your support, and you can do it. You can make a financial gift to help keep this public radio station strong and this program strong by making a call at 1-800-866-1475.
Once again, that's 1-800-866-1475. Mark, people are going online at mainpublic.org and sharing their support. I want to share a quick story. We had someone from Booth Bay, a Booth Bay business owner, call in, and the owner donated two passport memberships, gift memberships, wanted his employees to have access to passport while they were out of work and home with children. And I thought that was a terrific. So I know we haven't been talking about thank you gifts today that much, but passport is a benefit for folks who give $120 a year, one-time gift, or $10 a month. It's an amazing streaming service that we partner with PBS to provide for so many of our donors. And as you mentioned earlier, Mark, folks are watching more TV than ever before. And I'm thankful for PBS and for Maine Public Television. And I'm also thankful for Maine Calling and Maine Public Radio.
There's even more programming available now, an extra hour of PBS NewsHour, the specials that we've been doing on from Frontline and the coronavirus with Miles O'Brien. It's been remarkable, the hospitals out west, and how America is responding, and the fact that Maine Public is doing the CDC hearings with Dr. Shaw on a regular basis, and also the governor's press conferences. 1-800-866-1475. Have you been streaming Maine Public Television or Maine Public? You can just slide over to the red donate button at the top of the page and make a financial contribution right now. Any amount will do, actually, because participation is what matters.
That's right. Participation is key. People stepping up and are doing what they can do. We heard donors who are using their check,
stimulus check
to give money to nonprofits, and we're so appreciative of the thought of that and appreciate their support in any regards. And folks are doing that all across the state, Mark. And you know, we had a caller from Waterville, Maryland, called and just said, I wish everyone at Maine Public is healthy and well and stays healthy and well so they can continue to do the work that you're doing. And we appreciate those thoughts and those sentiments, and we appreciate your support. This is our Pledge From Home radio drive, our normally scheduled May radio drive. We do them quarterly. It's how we support the station and do the many things that we do here at Maine Public. You could help us out by calling 1-800-866-1475. Going online at mainpublic.org.
And please don't wait for the next quarterly pledge drive. Pledge now. This is important because you're listening now. We know that this is an unusual time, but it's also an unusual time to consider the value of Maine Public's NPR service, our journalists both here and around the world, the depth of content and information, and our music, frankly, Scott. And support that financially right now. No gift is too small. No gift is too large. What matters is the participation. And whether that's a monthly gift or a one-time gift, you choose. You make that difference for us at Maine Public. But we thank you in advance of making the gift. Consider an evergreen. Maybe, Scott, upgrade your to an additional gift. However it works for you, there's lots of choices here.
That's right, Mark. And every first-time donor to Maine Public right now is being matched. 100% of your support. If you've never supported Maine Public and you call or go online now, every dollar right now is being matched.
That's wonderful. At 1-800-866-1475. You can also donate online securely at mainpublic.org. Your support is the fuel that drives Maine Public Radio. Thanks.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking today about how people can participate in data collection that contributes to scientific research. My guests are Adrian Leppold with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife and Doug Hitchcox with Maine Audubon. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. If you send an email or tweet, do it quickly, please. Calling in now, Alyssa Baumann, Research Associate with the University of Maine and Citizen Science Coordinator for the Maine Forest Tick Survey. Alyssa, thanks for calling in.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So far in this program, we've been talking about looking for things people, I would say, want to find. This is a little different. People want to find beautiful birds in their backyard, but I suspect a lot of people aren't looking for lots of ticks in their backyard. Tell us about the Maine Tick Survey and what it's trying to achieve.
Yeah, definitely. So basically, what our goal of the project is to really try to understand this relationship between forest management practices and tick populations and tick pathogens. So we know people use a lot of different management techniques on their wooded properties. Some people are harvesting for timber. Some people have a forest management plan. Some people are controlling invasive plant species, et cetera. And so we're really trying to understand how these different management techniques impact ticks. And to do this, we're using citizen scientists across southern and coastal Maine. And these are the areas that have the highest rates of tick and tick-borne pathogens. And so basically, people don't necessarily want to go out and see the ticks, but I think people are very curious about what ticks are on their properties and what pathogens they may be carrying. And so that's one of the pieces of information that volunteers will get back is once they collect ticks for us, we will identify them, and then we're going to test them for pathogens, and then they'll have this great information about what's on their property.
Great. What do you tell people who are averse to ticks? How do you encourage them to participate?
Well, first of all, they don't ever have to touch any of the ticks with their hands. So we're going to send them something called a drag cloth. And it's basically a piece of cloth that you drag over the ground and the ticks latch onto that. And then we also send a pair of tweezers. So I can promise you, you will never have to have skin contact with any of the ticks.
All right. Well, Alyssa, thanks so much for joining us. Alyssa Baumann with UMaine, who coordinates the Maine Tick Survey. All of these projects we've been talking about on today's program will, of course, be on the Maine Calling webpage so that you can scroll through them, read about them, and share them with your friends. I want to return to Adrian and Doug, our guests who've been with us for the entire hour, and ask, Adrian, I'm going to start with you with the Maine Bird Atlas and other projects. You said that people don't have to have a lot of knowledge, and that may seem suspicious to some people, that how good can this scientific research be if people don't even know what they're talking about? Is it that when you have so much information, you're able to sort of, I'm not sure what the scientific word is for it, but account for the anomalies?
Yes, no, you're absolutely right, and that's a really valid question, and we get that frequently. It's a concern with any kind of citizen science or community science data that's collected. And so we target the information that we're asking people to collect, again, to be pieces of information that we feel confident that an individual could submit. So again, we don't want you to submit stuff that you're unsure of or that you don't know, but just tell us about what you do know. And maybe this prompts people to go out and learn something new as an effort to contribute to a project that they weren't even aware of or didn't think they could have before. So there's also, and I imagine many of these similar projects have the same kind of, you know, there's a level of quality control that goes on behind the scenes once the data is all submitted and collected and we run filters on it to pull out things that are really errant or anomalous. And for the most part, the errors that might slip through are going to kind of be drowned out by the rest of the data that comes in and how we're using it and, you know, using all these fancy statistical models and algorithms to correct for certain levels or amounts of error that is inherent in this kind of data. So I would definitely say to listeners out there to not let that idea discourage them and just, you know, be cognizant of, you know, use your own level of confidence. You know, we really only have one species of hummingbird in the East. So that's hard. It's hard to go wrong with a hummingbird. And I think it, especially as far as birds are concerned, most people, if they start thinking about it and really kind of you ask them to list off, you know, just start naming all of the birds that you can confidently identify, it's going to be more than most people would think. It's pretty easy to get up into the 20s and 30s and 40s without really feeling like you're a hardcore birder and, you know, really know all your birds. So at least, you know, for us, and that's the great thing about like the project that Alyssa just highlighted, you don't even have to know anything. We just need people out there doing the work to collect specimens, and then the trained scientists are on the other end filling in the missing pieces. So there's lots of ways to contribute to projects and not feel like you, you know, are doing more harm than good. That's rarely the case.
Doug Hitchcox, I know that so much of what Audubon does is leading things like group tours, nature walks, classroom visits, people coming to the various Audubon sites. How are you changing what you're doing and still trying to keep people engaged so that they will be excited enough to become citizen scientists or community scientists?
Yeah, we really have kind of made community science essentially a tier or pillar of just about all the work that we do. So even if it's just to kind of remind people that, you know, you have this responsibility, I guess, you know, if you're going to put in the effort to, you know, learn these birds or, you know what plants are in your backyard and, you know, have that ability to, you know, collect this data, I feel like we, you know, generally, everyone should feel some sort of responsibility towards that idea of giving back. And especially nowadays with just so many different avenues for, you know, reporting data in different projects, there's really, you know, endless opportunities for people to contribute.
Adrian, what do you have so far for the Maine Bird Atlas? How many people have posted an observation?
So we, as of the end of last year, we were around 1,350 individuals that had submitted observations through our online data entry platform, and we've recently increased the number of participants to over 1,500 just since the start of this year. And getting back to your previous question, too, about, you know, individuals' concerns about whether or not they know enough or could contribute and be helpful. We have a lot of resources out there and are making ourselves as available as possible to help train. You know, if you want to learn more and get involved, but just feel like you don't know enough, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. We have a calendar of events on our website under the Get Started link. And obviously all of those are virtual sessions now, where, you know, we kind of miss being able to travel around the state and meet people in person and train people in the field, but we're making the best of it. And we held a 3-hour long webinar a couple weeks ago, and we have weekly online Zoom sessions, Q&As that are just informal, and anybody can tune in and learn more and ask questions. And so I think that on some level, I think our current situation is actually helping these projects, because people are looking for ways to, you know, find purpose again and looking for reasons to get out there and engage with nature. And I think, especially for me, birds and nature provide some sense of constancy. And, you know, in these times of uncertainty, it's helpful to go back and be like, okay, spring migration, it's on track, it's on schedule, and all of our nesting birds are kind of bring with them the promise of new life. And so I think people even more so are excited to engage with that and try to connect with nature to find that grounding sense during these uncertain times.
Well, Adrian, I so agree with you. Speaking personally, we've been watching a bluebird box in our backyard through this whole sheltering in place, and it has been a really great sense of fun and joy for our family. And we've learned so much combined with watching the bluebirds. And then every time something happens, looking it up on the internet and learning about all sorts of things. So I really appreciate both of you giving us time today. Adrian Leppold directs the Maine Bird Atlas, a wildlife biologist with Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Also with us for the hour, Doug Hitchcox, staff naturalist with Maine Audubon. Sandra Harris ran the board today. This program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with Maine Public for the latest update from the CDC. CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah will be here in just a few minutes on television, radio, and online. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, a locally owned energy efficiency company, grateful for and proud to support Maine Public Radio. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And by Good Shepherd Food Bank, inviting you to help your neighbors in need while staying healthy at home. Learn how at feedingmaine.org.
And you're listening to Maine Public Radio, the stations of Maine Public Radio. A few minutes before 2 o'clock, I'm Mark Vogelsang along with Scott Marshallton. We're here taking a moment to encourage you to become a sustaining member, a supporting member, a donor, a financial contributor to your NPR station, Maine Public Radio. It's a great program that we had today with Jen Rooks and the team at Maine Public and Maine Calling. But it's so interesting to see all the folks who work behind the scenes to make this happen. Scott Marshallton, it's great to see you again. We're connecting by Zoom and by telephone, but it's a quick moment at the end of the show to remind people why contributing is important to us.
That's right, Mark. Folks have been calling 1-800-866-1475 and going online at MainePublic.org, hitting that red donate button, and really sharing their support with Maine Public, Maine Public Radio. I had Patricia called, increased her donation from $500 a year to become an Evergreen friend at the Beacon level, so $100 a month, $1,200 a year. And Patricia says, I've been thinking about increasing my membership, and this seems like the right time to do it. So, Patricia, thank you for your support. Thank you for becoming a Beacon-level donor, a $1,200-level donor. We've got about 850 donors that give at that level each and every year. The average gift is $2,500 for Maine Public. And those folks give not only for the enjoyment of supporting Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television for themselves, but also they're giving because it supports their community. The community they live in, their neighborhood, and they believe in the generosity of donating so Maine Public is there for others. Won't you join us today with your support?
1-800-866-1475, online at mainepublic.org, where you can make a secure pledge. You can do it by EFT, electronic funds transfer, with a credit card. You can make a one-time gift. However you want to do it, consider a gift of $25, $30, $50 a month or on a one-time level. Your pledge makes a difference to keep Maine Calling strong, to keep the programming strong, and keeps us allows us to do these press conferences and hearings that we've been on the air with Dr. Shah and from the CDC on a regular basis. You know, Scott, it's interesting. You mentioned the word beacon, and somebody earlier had called in and said Maine Public Radio is a beacon of light in right now, which feels sometimes like a pretty dark world. And public radio, if that describes you, we hope you'll make a financial contribution. You know, everyone in the world, Scott, has made changes, and here at Maine Public, it's forced us to think about the physical way we deliver public radio to you. But as we are, we're working as teams remotely, and so this is a fundraiser. This work-from-home fundraiser is something that no one's ever done before here at Maine Public, and it's a big experiment, but you can join in on this big experiment right now by making a call.
1-800-866-1475. Again, 1-800-866-1475. Go online at mainepublic.org. This is listener-supported Maine Public Radio.
And these are the stations of Maine Public Radio.